Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire Secretary of State Bill Gardner spent several hours of his 4th of July holiday fielding calls from voters upset about President Trump's Commission on Election Integrity and exactly what information it was seeking. The confusion began at the end of June when Commission Vice Chair Chris Kobach sent a letter to state officials like Gardner asking their advice on improving the integrity of federal elections and seeking data. In the letter, Kobach requests voter roll information if publicly available under the laws of the state, including full names, addresses, voting history, and more. That was last Wednesday. Since then, state reactions have varied in terms of how much or how little they plan to comply. And today in The Exchange, we gauge reaction here in New Hampshire. And let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests for the hour. Casey McDermott is here, NHPR reporter who covers state election issues. Also, Dave Scanlon, New Hampshire's Deputy Secretary of State. And Paul Toomey, longtime election law attorney. He served as legal counsel to the House of Representatives and as state legal counsel for several Democratic presidential campaigns. And welcome all of you. And let's just start off with what Governor Sununu said about what information New Hampshire plans to give this commission.
Not a bit of private information will be released. I will not allow that. Secretary Gardner agrees with that. This is all already readily available public information that candidates use, that the parties use, that those complaining about the dissemination of it are talking about. So, you know, it's already out there.
So, Casey McDermott, let's start with you. We heard it right from the governor. Public information, it's already out there. So why all the upset here in New Hampshire and other states?
So I think there are a few things going on here. One, I don't think that people knew that this information was public to begin with in some way. And just for a little bit of background, since about 2007, a law was passed that allowed state political parties, state political committees to buy copies of the statewide public voter checklist. And that's the same information that Secretary Gardner says that he is going to be sharing with the Trump Commission right now. But judging by just the feedback that we've seen, and it sounds like the feedback that the state has been receiving, a lot of people didn't even know that that was publicly available to those particular entities.
So it's relatively new over the past decade or so.
Yeah, yeah. And there have been a lot of, you know, outside data firms, political committees that have scooped up that data and used it to micro-target voters on a regular basis. That being said, there is a distinction in terms of what's available to, for example, a political committee versus what is available for actually having a copy of it for the average person. So if you're just, you know, an average New Hampshire resident and you want a copy of the statewide voter checklist, you can't get a copy of it. You can go and view it at a central location in the state archives building, or you can go town by town and aggregate those individual copies. So that's also
that would be a lot of work.
Right, right. And that's part of the concern that has been raised is, you know, is this commission getting preferential treatment, or, you know, what in the law would allow the state to share it with them in a way that would be different from what is kind of publicly available in terms of having an actual copy of it to the average person.
So that's how political parties, Casey, can, like you said, micro target, you know, voters like me. Mm-hmm. I get so much so much pamphlets and brochures and so forth on certain issues and on. But you're saying a lot of people don't even realize that that information is publicly available.
Our comments would indicate that, definitely. I think a lot of people, the response to the story was, this is an invasion of privacy. I don't want any of my information out there. And not to diminish those concerns at all, but just, you know, it should be noted that this information was already being shared and bought before this particular event.
So what information, Dave Scanlon, is specifically, as the governor said, publicly available, to quote him, already out there, and what isn't?
Okay. Well, first of all, good morning, Laura. And it might be a good idea to start off with just a brief history of voter checklists generally. Up until 2002, actually 2006, each city and town in New Hampshire maintained their own checklist in whatever format that they felt was appropriate for their town. If it was a city, they might have had a computer spreadsheet where they entered all the data. If it was a small town somewhere up in Coos County, those lists may still have been maintained by hand and handwritten out for every election cycle. Voter checklists is a tool. It's kind of a living document that shows who the qualified voters are in any particular voting district. And it really is a right for any voter, any citizen in New Hampshire to understand and be able to see who is actually participating in their elections. That's why we have marked checklists that are available for public review after an election, and anybody can go and look at those. The marked checklists contain the public data, the public information, and they can see which voters actually voted in any given election, whether they voted by absentee ballot or not. In 2002, the U.S. Congress passed the Help America Vote Act. And that act required all of the states to do a number of things, but one of the most prominent items was for every state to create a centralized statewide voter database. And that forced New Hampshire, when that law passed, to create a statewide centralized voter database. We had to take all of the town checklists in whatever format that they were in at the time, put them into a uniform set of data, and then create the list from all of that information. When Congress passed the act, they required New Hampshire to continue to collect the information that they had been, which was basically the name, the address of the voter, their party affiliation. I'm trying to remember whether there was birth date information on there or not. There probably was. But there may not have been much else. The federal act required that the state collect that information that I just mentioned, including birth dates, a driver's license number if the voter had one. If they did not have one, then they're required to collect the last four digits of the voter's Social Security number. And if the voter did not have either one of those, then they were assigned a random voter ID number, which was placed on the checklist. There's also information that's collected related to naturalization processes, where and when a person became a U.S. citizen, if they were here from another country. There's confidential information on there, actually a separate checklist for voters who are under some type of a protective order where their name cannot appear on a checklist for safety reasons. And all of that information is confidential. So when the legislature created the centralized database, they started looking at what should be public information and what should be private information.
Yeah, because there's a lot of information you just mentioned there, Dave, and some of it you can understand people wouldn't want widely shared.
Yeah. And so I'll read right from RSA 654-31-a, which is a right to know exemption specific to checklists. And it says the information contained on the checklist of a town or city, specifically the name, domicile address, which is your physical address, your mailing address, town or city, and party affiliation, if any, of registered voters, except as otherwise provided by statute, is public information subject to RSA 91A. RSA 91A, of course, is the right to know law, which means that
people can go in and see what happened.
See that information.
So again, give us that again, Dave, please. So what is it that is publicly available, as the governor said, as Casey reminded us, here in New Hampshire? There's just a couple things, it sounds like.
Public information is the name of the voter, the voter's party affiliation, if any, their physical address, their mailing address, And voter history is also public. Anybody can go look at a marked checklist.
And history obviously doesn't mean how you voted because nobody knows, but it means, you know, Laura showed up in, you know, 2000, but she didn't show up in 2002. That's basically it.
That's what that means. Yeah.
So here's the question for you, Dave, and Paula, I do want to get you in, obviously. The letter from Vice Chair Kobach does specify if publicly available under the laws of your state. And we put a link to that letter on our website if listeners want to see the whole thing. Given that specification, why do you think this letter has caused such an uproar here in New Hampshire and in other states, a fair number of which are led by Republicans?
I think it is, as Casey mentioned earlier, that the average voter may not realize that their public information is readily available to anybody that wants to see it. The other important thing to understand is that different states have different laws related to what is public and what is private.
So some states might reveal more than we do.
Some states might reveal more. Some states possibly might reveal less. I just cited what the public information was in New Hampshire. I should also say, too, that when the U.S. government, the Congress passed the Help America Vote Act and made these requirements of the states, they also paid for it. So New Hampshire received, at the time, about $17 million to do all of this work and create the database, and they continue to pay for ongoing maintenance.
Well, Paul, let's get you into it. And you've been upset about this. What do you think? The governor pointed out that political parties, like the Democratic Party, pay for this information. As Casey told us, they use it to target voter outreach efforts. What's the difference between that and what this federal commission is looking for?
Okay. First of all, let me just say right off the bat that if I were writing this statute, I wouldn't give it out to the parties or the candidates either, because I think micro-targeting is itself a bad thing because it tends to let the candidates and the parties put the voters into silos and they don't talk to voters who don't already agree with them. So I think for a policy purpose, I would change the statute and not allow it for any purposes. But that said, there's a little bit more to it than what the governor said, and it goes beyond a little bit what David Scanlon just said, is the information isn't just available. It's available to different types of entities in different forms. In the statute, for example, the towns can give out the public information to any person that comes around one by one to the towns or the wards and picks up the information. But it's up to the towns or the wards whether they give it to them in paper, whether they do it digitally, or the type of access. The Secretary of State, you know, if somebody wants the whole thing at once, he can make it available at the archive that somebody can come in and look at it. But the statute says they can't copy it, they can't photograph it, they can't transmit it in any way. So the public's right to know the data and know who's voted is protected. But at the same time, the legislature was trying to protect the right to privacy, because the way you give this information out really determines of how much of an impact on somebody's privacy there is. If you give it out in a digital form, the commission intended to take all this public information and put it online in a searchable data form so that anybody, you know, foreign power or criminals, could use it to basically hack people, you know, put together ways to get at really sensitive stuff in their stuff like medical records.
So what's at the core of your concern, Paul? Is it that this is online, it's not protected? Is it that the commission is asking for this in the first place? Is it that you're afraid the commission might misuse the information? What's really bothering you most about this?
Well, to start with, my baseline problem with it is that we have a statute and it says how this information can be given out. And I think, first of all, in the state of New Hampshire, we have to follow that law. We can't just give it out in a digital form to somebody who's going to put it online when the legislature has gone to such lengths. If you look at the statute, I mean, it's fairly detailed as to the form in which it can be given out. And again, that's to protect the public. So as an absolute baseline, I agree that there is a way that people could see the information there. And I think that's important, too. But to give it out in a digital form to somebody who's going to put it on the World Wide Web, I have a real problem with that. We know that Vladimir Putin tried to hack 39 state databases like this. hope somebody will ask David Scale one if ours was one of them. We don't know the states. But there'd be no need for him to do that. That's hard for him to do, and it's 39 separate attempts, so that leaves footprints and people, you know, our security things were able to know they were going to do that. If this stuff's all online, he doesn't have to hack anybody. It's all there for whatever purposes they want to use, and one of which is the sort of the micro-targeting that campaigns here use. We know in the last presidential election, the Russians, or at least we're told the Russians, we're using it for that purpose.
So it sounds like security of this data is one of your big concerns. And we've seen a lot of data breaches, you know, the Office of Personnel Management at the federal government, lots and lots of personal information released. Dave Scanlon, have you gotten any assurances from the administration that this data will be well protected? And can you even make those promises in this day and age when hacks seem to be, you know, happening with increasing regularity?
There's a number of points that I'd like to make, responding to Paul as well. The commission has not yet met. They're meeting for the first time, I believe, next week. There may have been a phone conversation or two, but I think a lot of the questions that are being asked are going to be answered after they have an opportunity to meet. I think it's important to understand that the public data is the same public data for anybody that's asking for it. There is no difference whether you're an average citizen or whether you're a political party or you're a political committee. If you want to see the data, there's only one set of data that you're going to be able to see. The law does provide that it be given in different formats. So if somebody goes into their town clerk's office and says, I want to purchase the town checklist, they can request for a paper copy, or they can ask for it on a disk, or any other format that the town is able to provide. As far as the state goes, the law is pretty clear that we can only sell an entire statewide checklist to either a political party, a candidate who's running for office, and in the case of a candidate, we can sell a candidate a list for just their district that they're running for, or a political committee that is registered in the state of New Hampshire. The political parties are by far the largest users of the checklist information, and the list have been purchased by not only the state Republican and Democratic committees, but also at the national level. And when they obtain those lists, they use it to update the databases that they have created. But their databases actually contain far more information than what we have in the state. They add telephone numbers to those lists when they can get it. They add email addresses. They add demographic information and whatever else they can find to target to target their audience when they are working on campaigns.
So it's a deeper data dive than some of the information that we're talking about the Secretary of State giving to this commission. Casey, do you want to jump in, please?
Yeah, and while Dave is correct that political parties make up a significant proportion of the state's overall voter checklist sales, there are, if you look at kind of the individual buyers, the largest buyer of checklist sales dating back to 2008 is a company called Catalyst, which bills itself as a data utility powering the progressive community. And their website kind of boasts that they enhance, store, and dynamically update data on over 240 million unique voting age individuals in the United States. And they do that by combining, like Dave said, the kind of finite publicly available information that they get on a regular basis from New Hampshire with all of these other metrics that they compile in these databases. And they're not the only company that does that with New Hampshire's data. There are other ones, Independent Data, Free State Data, Granite State Freedom Pack, that have ties to out-of-state data firms that do exactly what Dave just said, that also buy a lot of checklists.
So lots and lots of inside and outside the state politically leaning organizations, Casey, interested and purchasing this data. We got a lot of response to this story on Twitter when we asked, should New Hampshire turn over voter data to the commission? Joseph says, can't you just buy voter data? We talked about that, I think, that groups can, but individuals cannot. And then someone with the name Number 5 says, this New Hampshire voter says no. I think New Hampshire allows sharing of public data, hoping Bill Gardner does the right thing, but he is on the committee. We'll take a lot more of your reaction in just a moment, and we'll hear from Maine's Secretary of State. All that's coming up, so stay with us.
I was wondering.
I'm curious to know more about.
My question is, what is a filibuster?
How does the Electoral College work?
What is required for declaring war?
A majority whip.
Congressional caucuses?
You've got questions? We've got answers. Civics 101, the shame-free podcast refresher course on how our democracy works. There is no such thing as a stupid question. So ask away and subscribe to Civics 101 on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcasts.
Thank you so much. Keep up the excellent work.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoi. Today, confusion and concern over a federal request for voter information in the states. The Exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are David Scanlon, New Hampshire's Deputy Secretary of State, Casey McDermott, NHPR reporter who covers state election issues for us, and Paul Toomey, longtime election law attorney who served as legal counsel to the House of Representatives and as state legal counsel for several Democratic presidential campaigns. And all of you, let's go to our listeners. And Cody is joining us from Concord. Hi, Cody. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome. Go ahead, Cody. You're on the Exchange.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm calling in because there's this concept of military intelligence that's essential elements of friendly information. And what it's about is gathering a comprehensive profile on individuals by combining information from various sources. And each one of them may not have a complete picture of an individual, but whenever you put them all together, then you have very sensitive information about those individuals. So if we take our voter information and we actually put it into a centralized database, then hackers or hostile entities would just have to break in and actually get that information.
And that would help them create a more detailed profile. And I think that's something that Paul Toomey expressed earlier. Dave Scanlon, do you want to jump in?
Well, we go to great lengths to make sure that our private data on voters is kept private. And we know, like any government entity, there are individuals or sources that try to get into the into the database. But to the best of our knowledge, we have not had anybody that has been successful getting into our system. And our voter database is protected within our department, but we also set behind the firewalls of the state of New Hampshire.
And still, given the Office of Personnel Management hack, a year or so ago, that was huge at the federal level. I'm sure they had all sorts of firewalls and stuff to try to prevent that. But hackers are smart, and they seem to enjoy doing this.
All I can say is that the information that we're submitting is public information that is readily available. I don't see the. Yeah,
as Governor Sununu said, it's already out there.
It's already out there. And New Hampshire participated for the first time in an interstate cross-check program where we actually bumped our public information of voters up against the voters of other states.
To make sure people weren't trying to vote in one state.
It's an effort to keep the voting list clean and also to prevent double voting. We received about 95,000 matches when compared with the other states in the country that participated in the program. And when we got the list of matches back, we were able to do internal matches where we added middle initials or middle names. That cut that number in half. And so as we put the additional layers on in New Hampshire, we're reducing that number into something that's manageable. But the important thing to know is that we entered agreements with those states to keep that information private. And as soon as that data was compared, the data that we had sent down to the cross-check program was deleted.
Paul, real quick, go ahead.
Okay. The public information, there is public information that's available, but the way it's available is essentially either going town to town and getting a paper list or going to the archives and searching it. That is a completely, if you're talking about security and putting together files on people as the caller was, that's totally different than putting an entire searchable, online searchable database on the web, which is what's proposed here.
Actually, Paul, I haven't seen that proposed. Maybe you can tell me where it is.
If you look at the last line of Mr. Kobach's letter, I think it's the last line, in his letter he says it will be publicly made available.
I don't read it that way, but we can get into that in a minute.
But let me just finish the point. The public information on its own may not seem like it's that harmful, which is, you know, your address, you know, da-da-da. Cybersecurity experts say that when you take that seemingly harmless information and then combine it with all the other information that's available on the web, that you can draw an extremely detailed portrait of a person and invade their medical records, things like all kinds of things.
As Cody said, so maybe this doesn't have that much information in it, but you can put that together with something else.
Right.
I actually have Vice Chair Kobach's letter right in front of me, and we put it on our website if folks want to look at them themselves. It does say, please be aware that any documents that are submitted to the full commission will also be available to the public. I want to bring another voice into our conversation, all of you. Yeah, go ahead.
But if you look at the letter, there's a long list of other documents other than the checklist that they are requesting, information that they're requesting on there. I think many states, you know, would have issues with the checklist information being put up publicly. I don't think that sentence is referring specifically to the checklist more than it is those the other information that is also requested in the letter.
Do we know that for sure?
No, because the commission has not met yet.
Okay, so some more questions out there. I do need to bring another voice into our conversation. We're interested to know how other states have been reacting to this, especially around New England. So joining us now from Maine is Matthew Dunlap. He's Maine's Secretary of State, who also, like Secretary Gardner, serves on the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. And Secretary of State Dunlap, it's really nice to have you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So as I understand, you started out saying, sure, we'll share this information. What was your thinking there initially?
Well, that was a little bit of misreporting. What we had said was that if the entity qualified for the voter file, this is what they would get. You know, and it's very similar to what Mr. Scanlon described coming out of New Hampshire. Although our law says that you get the name, the address, the year of birth, you know, party enrollment, registration status, and a few other high-level things, we would not release the last four digits of the Social Security number or other proprietary information about the citizen. And I think people took it to mean that we were planning on releasing it, as we do with any request. And in Maine, under Maine law, there are entities that are, you know, that are entitled to get a copy of the list, candidates, issue campaigns, political parties. After that, it gets a little bit murkier. An institution doing research can obtain a copy of the voter file. A governmental entity can obtain a copy for the same purpose. But under any circumstance, and this is where, you know, we did a close reading of our statute, and our statute is actually quite clear that anybody who gets a copy of the voter file must keep it confidential. And it's very explicit in the law that it has to be confidential. And it says that when we read the letter, and because I'm on the commission, as you noted, and we talked about, you know, how we were going to proceed, and this was something that some folks on the commission were interested in examining, which is people who are registered to vote in more than one state, which, by the way, is not a crime. It's only a crime if you vote in more than one state in one election. So, but I think they wanted to get some baseline information, and we talked about gathering up some data, and we talked on the call about, you know, making that a request and not a demand, and only accessing that information that a state was allowed to make available. So, when the request was made, you know, and the media got a hold of it, it was such an uproar. I thought, oh my God, how did they word this letter? I mean, it sounded like people were being rounded up, for crying out loud. And when I read the letter closely, I thought, you know, this is a request for information. So we took a step back, because this was sort of a one-off. It's not a candidate or an issue campaign or a political party. It is for research. we wanted to make sure that it qualified under Maine's statutes.
So and, how do you feel about it now that you've had a little time to reflect? Does it qualify or not?
It does not. And it was, I sat down with the Attorney General, and it's a clear conflict for us that because in the letter it states that this has got to be part of the public documents of the commission, and you know, our statute that says it has to be held in confidentially, you know, we could not convey it. And also, too, the confidential clause in our law is directory, whereas, you know, people who can access the voter file is discretionary. The Secretary of State may provide. So given that, we felt it was the safest course without further clarity about the disposition of the record to not convey it.
Well, and I asked our guests here from New Hampshire the same question, but I'll ask you, Secretary of State Dunlap. The letter to Kobach, from Kobach to you, which again we have on our website, says, I'm requesting you provide publicly available voter roll data for Maine, if publicly available under the laws of your state. So he says pretty clearly twice, publicly available. As our governor said, look, it's already out there. Why are people getting so hot under the collar? I wonder what you think.
Well, you know, it's fascinating, you know, because we were sort of on the front lines on the Real ID debate, which is, you know, completely separate from this. And, you know, I was right in the breach on that for 10 years. And what Real ID requires is exponentially more invasive than what is available in the voter file. I mean, Real ID requires us to, because I'm one of three secretaries of state that has oversight of motor vehicles, so this is really relevant to us. And it requires people to have their photographs taken using facial recognition mapping technology, which is part of the database. You'd bring in your certified birth certificate or passport or other identifying documents, and those would be scanned into the database, which would be accessible by federal officials. And people, you know, the legislature fell down all over itself to comply with that because they didn't want people to be inconvenienced in travel and their businesses. And to this day, we get phone calls, people, you know, demanding to know when the Real ID is going to be available because they have a business with drivers who can't get onto military bases because they don't have passports.
Sure. So why are people so upset about this?
Yeah. You contrast that with this, and the uproar has been unbelievable. I mean, we've gotten hundreds and hundreds of emails. The phone's been ringing off the hook. We've been getting letters, you know, you name it.
So what's that about?
The difference is, upon reflection, is that when you talk about the electoral process and people participating in democracy and the backdrop of this polarized climate nationally that we're in, the idea that federal officials are going to be looking at your name and your voter history, for what purpose, it really sets them off. And I guess on hindsight, we probably should have been able to predict that, but you know, now we have a better understanding of what people's sentiments are about their private information vis-a-vis the voter file.
So, Secretary of State Dunlap, you're on this commission, again, along with Secretary Gardner here in New Hampshire. How awkward is it for you to go down to D.C. for that first meeting and say, you know, hi, I'm a member of this group, but I don't want this group to have this information?
You know, it's a matter of following the law. It's not awkward at all. And, you know, I've been in a lot of situations where I've had to switch hats from time to time, you know, and actually, you know, and Secretary Gardner is one of the most highly respected and experienced secretaries of state in the country. People think the world of Secretary Gardner. And, you know, I don't know why they asked me, probably because I'm now one of the senior members of our national organization. I never planned on being here for 12 years, but here I am. And I think, you know, because I think both of us approach this in an open-minded fashion. It's like, let's see where this takes us. Now, frankly, I have said right down the line, I don't think this commission is going to find very much. However, sunlight is a great disinfectant, you know, and there's this cloud that keeps being wrought about people voting in multiple jurisdictions or, you know, some type of insidious voter fraud going on. Now, when I was out of office for a term, because again, like New Hampshire, I'm elected by the legislature, and our legislature changed hands, and that was the way that was. And Secretary Summers was encouraged to do an investigation of 300 college students who were from around New England. But
that's
not
a familiar issue here in New Hampshire as well, concerns about college students. Last question for you, Secretary of State Dunlap. Your governor, Paul LePage, was a strong Donald Trump supporter. What has he had to say about your decision to withhold this information?
He said nothing about it, actually, because we just got done with a government shutdown. We had a several-day shutdown based on an impasse on the state budget that was just resolved on Tuesday. So I suspect everybody is taking a deep breath right now. But I have heard nothing negative about this. I've had one or two people say, what are we trying to hide? And somebody else responded, we're not hiding anything. We're trying to protect our information.
Wow.
So, sentiments have been very, very strong in opposition towards conveying this data. Which is, it gives me some comfort knowing that, again, we're just following the letter of the law. This is not a political decision. It's basically a legal decision. And if the posture of the commission's request changes and they're able to do something different with this information to keep it confidential, keep it classified, or whatever the terminology is, we'll revisit that at the time. I think, again, getting back to the investigation of the 300 college students, what they found was absolutely nothing.
Okay.
And this is a point I think we need to keep close to our hearts. And, Maine and New Hampshire are very close to each other, physically and in terms of our cultures. Maine is bigger than the rest of New England. We have 5,000 bodies of water. We have 3,000 miles of lakes and streams. We have 225,000 licensed fishermen.
Okay, wait. No tourism promotion here, Secretary
Dunlap. No, but you are more likely. You're more likely to be hit by lightning than to see a game warden in the Maine woods. And yet, our compliance for buying a fishing license is 98%.
So you're basically saying, examples of voter fraud are extremely rare. And I'm so glad you raised that point, because I'm going to ask our guests about that. That's the hope of our Secretary of State, that this will clear up all these concerns about voter fraud. I want to really thank you for your time, Secretary of State Dunlap, this morning. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
That's Matthew Dunlap, Maine Secretary of State, who, as we heard, also serves on the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. Casey McDermott, back to you. In a pretty extensive interview with Secretary of State Gardner the other day, Josh Rogers and several other reporters talked to Bill Gardner about why he's on this commission, why he feels the way he does. And he echoed what Matthew Dunlap said, trying to clear up this nagging perception that there's voter fraud.
Right. And I talked to the secretary on Friday as well about that same thing. And he said as much in my conversation with him. And I think that, frankly, he was a little bit surprised, I think, at the level of backlash that this commission and his involvement on it has elicited. And he said as much as the secretary from Maine said, that he is going into this with a very open mind. He, understands that people have concerns, but his position was basically, let us get started. We haven't done anything yet, outside of perhaps this, now very significant request that's being made. He said, we've only spoken by phone. We're going to meet for the first time in an official capacity later this month. Let us go through the process. Let us see what we find. If at the end of it there are concerns to be had, then those are valid. But his position was very much that, don't prejudge before we do anything here.
What do you think, Paul?
I think that the secretary wants to, and I've heard him also say, too many people think that there's voter fraud. He says there really isn't much of it, just as Secretary Dunlap just said, but we have to get rid of that preconception.
Perception. And that's his big hope that I've heard him say time and time again about this commission.
And I wouldn't have a problem if he were on a true bipartisan commission doing that. But he's on a commission that is absolutely stacked with the same people, including Mr. Kobach, who have spent the last two decades creating that misperception. This isn't a bipartisan commission. There was a bipartisan commission, I think, 4 years ago that had two co-chairs, one of whom was Ben Ginsburg, who was Romney's counsel, and one of whom was Bob Bauer, who was Obama's counsel. And that was a evenly matched up commission, and they looked at it and they made a lot of recommendations that, quite frankly, it's a shame they haven't been followed through, because there are a lot of things to fix with elections. But this commission is set up to come to preconceived decisions, and the two secretaries of state are not going to change that.
Although Matthew Dunlap and Bill Gardner are Democrats, so there's participation there.
No. They are people that were Democrats before they became secretaries of state. They're on there as secretary of state in their nonpartisan position. There are no Democrats, real Democrats, on that.
All right, and Bill, Dave Scanlon is shaking his head on what you said, Paul. So we'll follow up with you after a short break, Dave, and we'll keep taking your calls. So stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, confusion and concern over a federal request for voter information in the states. We're looking at the recent request from the president's Election Integrity Commission and its request that secretaries of state hand over publicly available information on voters. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Paul Toomey's here, a longtime election law attorney, along with Casey McDermott, NHPR reporter who covers election issues for us. And Dave Scanlon's here, New Hampshire's Deputy Secretary of State. Before we go back to our listeners, Dave Scanlon, I did want to give you a chance to jump in on something that Paul said before the break that has been said a lot. People say they just suspect the motives of this campaign. This commission. They think it's all about Donald Trump proving that he actually won the popular vote. It's about proving Vice Chair Kobach's long expressed concern that there's, you know, deep and widespread voter fraud in this country, which has not been proven. What is your take on those concerns? Because there's a lot of sort of conspiracy theories about what this is really about.
Yeah, this commission needs a chance to do what would be really important work. And unfortunately, in today's political climate, we have two sides that are very polarized. And on one hand, there are concerns about the process being opened up so much that all a person has to do to vote is just wave to the ballot clerk and pick up their ballot, which concerns a lot of people about, you know, are the people that are voting actually qualified to vote here, versus the other side of the spectrum where all the concerns are about voter suppression. And, you know, all that's trying to be done here is just prevent people from voting so that, you know, they can win their election by whatever means. At some point, we have to start to come together and, you know, talk about these issues, get the data that we need to figure out what is the reality, what is really going on. Either we're going to disprove that there's large-scale voter fraud taking place, or we're going to prove it.
Haven't most secretaries of state said there is no voter fraud?
They have said that. But if you look at a number of polls that are out there, there are large percentages of our population, just the average person on the street, that believes that it happens. We have people in New Hampshire that actually believe that they have seen busloads of voters going to the polls and dropping off voters to vote. And the only way we can deal with that perception is turn it into a reality one way or the other. You know, based on the data, we know that it is or it is not happening. So this commission has been created, and granted, people may not like the president or they may have issues with Secretary Kobach of Kansas. But Bill Gardner is on this commission. He's got a 40-year track record of just top-notch public service to the state of New Hampshire. We have Matt Dunlap, who is made from the same cloth as Bill Gardner. And if you can't have faith in those two guys, among the others that are also on the commission, Connie Lawson from Indiana, and even Chris Kobach is a person that you can talk to, and you know, he will listen to arguments.
I've heard some commentary that Mr. Kobach himself, if the goal really is to clear up this perception of voter fraud, that he was a poor choice given his past involvement in being super tough on, you know, these sorts of issues. That he was, if you really wanted to get at this in a bipartisan way, he was not the guy to pick.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get into whether he was a good choice or a bad one, but he certainly knows the subject matter.
But he comes at it from a very sharp one angle.
He does, but he's going to be tempered by, you know, the other members of the commission who we know are able to stand up for themselves and carry the water that, you know, that needs to be hauled.
Carry the water from their states, like that's Maine, right, and New Hampshire. Go ahead, Paul Toomey.
Chris Kobach, 10 days ago, was fined, I think, $1,000 by a federal court for being dishonest in his statements to the court about voter fraud. And that, I mean, that's an astonishing thing. Now, that's a person that a federal court 10 days ago fined him for lying about and being dishonest and trying to mislead the court. That's who you want to control your commission and to run it and to send out letters on his own, supposedly. I don't think so. I mean, it's just not a fair commission. I mean, it's stacked. The numbers are stacked. There are no people that on that commission that strongly oppose Mr. Kobach.
Let's hear from U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen. You mentioned the concern about voter suppression, that this is really what it's all about. Senator Shaheen talked to reporters at an event on the 4th of July. This is from WMUR.
This is, I think, the beginnings of an effort at voter suppression to try and prevent people who may not be voting in the way that the administration wants from voting in the future.
Again, that's U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen, some sound courtesy of WMUR. Casey, what other sort of concerns, suspicions have you heard from people about what this commission is really after?
Well, I think that there is that overarching concern, given both the rhetoric that we have heard from the Trump administration, from the president himself, who made repeated claims about a number of illegal votes here in New Hampshire and in other states, the concerns that have been articulated with regard to Secretary Kobach have also been ones that I've seen repeatedly. Just by way of a little bit of background, Chris Kobach offers up or has created a number of years ago this interstate voter registration cross-check program, which New Hampshire recently entered into, that allows New Hampshire to share voter information with other states for the purposes of comparing duplicate voters. I think that's what Deputy Secretary of Scanlon was referring to before in terms of the number of initial matches that the state saw with different states. But again, it's important to note that just because someone is registered to vote in multiple states, that is not in and of itself illegal. That happens, you know. I moved here from Pennsylvania three years ago, and my name might have been on the rolls until it was removed through the regular kind of voter cleaning process. That doesn't mean that I was not voting in both states, but you know that's the way that it works in a kind of transient society that we live in right now. But Chris Kobach has used the existence of people registered in more than one state to create kind of the perception or fuel existing perceptions that in and of itself is evidence of fraud or suggests that there is this kind of widespread fraud. So I think that kind of, you know, that rhetoric as a pretext for this commission, which initially was also created as it's called the Election Integrity Commission, but more recently the president himself has referred to it as a voter fraud commission. That also, just in summarizing the commentary that I've seen from members of the public about this, that has added to the concerns about what the intentions of this commission actually are.
Let's go back to our listeners, hear what they think. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Nicole's from Portsmouth. Go ahead, Nicole. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, hi, Laura. I'm on July 4th. I actually was one of those people who called Bill Gartner, and he spent a half an hour explaining to me his position.
Wow.
Which I really appreciate.
So you called the Secretary of State's office on the 4th of July, and Bill Gartner picked up.
He did.
Okay.
And as I said, I thought that I would just leave a message, and he spent a half an hour speaking with me, and only in New Hampshire does that happen. And he went through it all, and I'm very much opposed to giving the commission this information. I don't trust the motives at all. I think that they may be up to stuff that we haven't even considered. But Bill Gardner did make the point of if there are so many people who believe that voter fraud exists, if we don't give information, are we not just feeding that idea? Are we just, you know, sort of confirming, oh, yes, they're not even going to give information, thereby proving that there is voter fraud?
And the president made that point, too. What are they trying to hide, these states that aren't participating? So given that conversation, how do you feel about this now, Nicole?
Well, I'm still opposed and I'm very suspicious, but it does leave us with the question of then what do we do? How do we get rid of this idea? If there isn't actually voter fraud, how do we get that information across?
Yeah.
And I wish I had an answer to that.
Well, that's the million-dollar question. Yeah, I really appreciate you calling in, Nicole. And what do you think, Dave Scanlon, about what she said? She's really appreciative that she got the chance to speak with the Secretary of State himself, but suspect of the motives of this commission.
I can certainly understand the feeling of being suspect, especially if you don't completely understand what's on the checklist and how the information is going to be used. But you come back to the same question that she asked at the end. How do you deal with resolving the issue that's out there. Do we have a problem with voter fraud or not? And, you know, for all of those that believe that it occurs on a wide scale, how do you show to them that, you know, this really isn't the problem that they think it is, and we should have more trust and faith in our election process?
And I've heard you express and the Secretary of State express this hope that if this commission can come together, give it a chance, do its work, as Secretary Gardner himself has said, you know, we can put to rest this perception. In this highly charged political environment that you referenced earlier, Dave, how optimistic are you that, you know, people will say, oh, great, the commission says there is no voter fraud, then we can all go home happy? Or will people just start taking pot shots at the commission?
I think people always take pot shots at the commission. But I'm a firm believer that they can actually do something that benefits our country. It may not end there, but we have to at least get started. I mean, something has to start the process of resolving these issues.
We have to try.
Yes,
is what you're saying. Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
Again, it's somewhat ironic to say that you're going to rely on people to dispel a misconception that they themselves created. And I'm talking about Mr. Kobach and several other members of this commission. There, I do agree this misperception is out there, and it would be helpful to us as a society to dispel it. But setting up a commission with the people that created it is the wrong way. Again, we had a bipartisan election commission with Ben Ginsburg, who has represented not only the Romney, but about almost every major Republican in the country. They looked at all these kind of things, and they came up with a lot of suggestions for elections, but none of these were part of it. You could set up a fair commission. You could give them whatever information they needed in a safe way that wouldn't be put on the internet. But this isn't it. This is a different animal.
Go ahead, Casey.
There's also, just getting back to the Help America Vote Act that Deputy Secretary Scanlon was referencing at the beginning of the show. That came along with the creation of the Election Assistance Commission, which is a federal body that has been looking at, while not specifically issues around fraud, a number of issues with regard to voting technology, voting improvement, election systems. There's extensive data about votes cast, types of votes, all kinds of stuff on their website. So from a kind of data collection, data analysis standpoint, there are other places that are kind of, you know, have at least the semblance of like nonpartisanship that are already out there kind of working on, you know, election issues generally.
And right. I'm guessing that law came out, Casey, and that effort came out of the 2000 election,
exactly.
The disputed,
yes,
Bush-Gore,
yeah,
election. Go ahead, Paul.
The Election Assistance Commission, which is a very good source of information, by the way, last week the Republican House of Representatives in Washington voted to zero out their budget. They don't want them existing. So, I mean, you can read what you want into that.
Let's take another call. This is Julie in Keene. Hi, Julie. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead, Julie.
Well, my original reason for calling has changed since the last few comments. And the thing I want to say right now is that for those of us who are on the distrustful side, it seems ironic to me that they're going to say, well, we're going to produce data that's going to change people's minds, when the very situation we're in this world is that data and information and research and facts have been widely discredited by the people who don't want to believe them. So how data is going to change anybody's mind in this current culture is beyond me. You would need Fox News to say that they support the data and, oh, no, there is no voter fraud before people would be willing to even think about changing their minds.
So not feeling. Oh, go ahead, Julie. Yeah.
I just want to have one other thing to say, which is, given the fact that voter fraud is by and large a myth, in the end, they're going to have all this data. They're going to have this data in the end. When all that's done, all that data is going to be collected in a place that we don't have any control over.
Well, and so, reflecting the security concerns that you expressed earlier, Paul, and also reflecting the question I asked you earlier, Dave, is, you know, is it overly optimistic to assume that in this era of suspicion and distrust, all of a sudden everyone's going to say, hooray, look at what the commission said. Let's go with that.
No, I don't believe for a minute that would happen. But we have to start somewhere, and you know, I mean, I don't know how we got to the state that we're in where we're so polarized that we can't sit down and have a conversation about the issues and what's really going on. And that's what this is all about. Now, you know, people may not like the players, but at least the players are coming together. They're sitting down. They're going to have a conversation. And that's how you start.
You know, I had a question earlier when we were talking about what information is already publicly available to groups like some of the political groups that Casey mentioned and candidates and so forth. Why can't this commission just get it that way? Why does it have to make this special request to the Secretary of State and pay the $8,300, I think, that the Secretary of State said that
if an entity was to purchase the list, that's what it would cost. The groups that receive it that way, I mean, the only restriction on the use is that those lists cannot be used for commercial purposes in New Hampshire. They could be shared. You know, I suppose if the commission wanted to call up the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and say, hey, you know, would you give us your lists? I don't know what would happen. But I know that those lists have a lot more information on them than what is being requested.
I see.
Of the state of New Hampshire. It's just a simple public information on the database. And the commission would know that the source of the information is entirely accurate, that it hasn't been manipulated in some manner in between.
By a political group.
That's right.
Go ahead, Paul.
One interesting thing is that Mr. Kobach actually has all this information because he is the head of this cross-check program. And we have a statute that authorized the Secretary of State to pick a program with which to try to get rid of these duplicates, which is a good idea. There is, by the way, a nonpartisan thing that was set up by the Pew Foundation that would have done it. Mr. Kobach can't use it because our statute that allowed us to share it with his organization said he couldn't transfer it to anybody. It had all kinds of security things.
That's not true, Paul. The cross-check is a place where states go to compare the voter information, and once that's done, the data is destroyed.
And so, it's a state-to-state relationship, not a federal-to-state relationship.
It's a state-to-state relationship.
Is that correct?
Right,
yeah.
But Kobach's the one who set it up, and there are all sorts of restrictions on what that program can do with it.
The information is destroyed. Right. As soon as the matches take place, it's gone.
So I don't think we disagree. I think we agree.
I think you seem to be saying, Paul, you don't feel like this is necessary and you don't trust the fact that this data isn't, you know, it's going to stay out there and it could be hacked and shared.
Well, it's clearly he's going to put it on the internet. It's not going to be destroyed. The letter says they're going to make it available to the public.
Well, the meeting is next week. So I'm counting on Casey McDermott to fill us in on what happens there when the Secretary of State goes down. I want to thank everybody very much for being with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.